The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Jason Fried. Jason is the CEO and co-founder of Basecamp. His TED Talk, Why Work Doesn't Happen at Work, has been viewed by 4.5 million people, and he writes a monthly column for Inc. magazine. Jason has authored a number of books, including Rework, Remote, Office Not Required, and Getting Real. Jason Fried, welcome to Getting the Yes And.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
All right, in reading your books and articles, I found a very compelling theme that is both what I think of as a point of view and a point of context, and that is, you have the point of view of a person who is a positive and healthy gadfly within a context that tells us that many, if not a majority, of our cultural assumptions about work and the workplace are fundamentally wrong.
That's true.
Okay.
That's true. I think that there's a lot of things going on that's wrong at work in general. Mm-hmm. I think businesses are really good at one thing, and that's wasting time. They're wonderful at wasting time. Meetings, conference calls, just the machinery of business mm-hmm. is about wasting time, unfortunately. And so people end up working longer and longer hours, and they can't get stuff done at work, like my TED Talk kind of went into. But I really think that 40 hours actually is plenty of time. It's plenty of time if you squeeze out all the stuff that you don't need to do. And so I'm really big into that approach at work, not working longer and taking on more stuff, but trying to squeeze out all the stuff you don't need to do, and you're left with plenty of time to do great things.
You also have a contention that the workplace might not be the best place to actually get work done.
Yeah, everyone knows that. Everyone knows that.
Not everyone knows that.
Well, I think everyone knows it, but they don't admit it.
Yes.
If you ask people when they go to work, you know, where do you need to really get, if you really need to get something done, where would you go? They're not going to say the office at 2:30 in the afternoon. They just don't say that. They'll say like early in the morning, late at night, I'll stay home, maybe on a flight, cross-country flight, I'll have 4 or 5 hours to myself. That's the only time you actually have 4 or 5 hours to yourself these days is like on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that signals that the office is not a great place to actually work. It's a good place to do other things, mostly be interrupted, but it's not a great place to actually work.
Yeah, you had a phrase where you said you're trading in work days for work moments.
Right. Most people's days are chunked into small bits now, 15 minutes at a time, 30 minutes at a time. And if you're going to do creative work, you need uninterrupted stretches of time to think it through, to work on it, and not be interrupted constantly. I think I talk about this, I think it was in Rework, maybe in that TED thing too, I talked about sleep and work are very similar.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, if you think about, if you're being interrupted while you're sleeping every night, like every 45 minutes by someone or something, you know you're not going to have a good night's sleep.
Right.
But if that was the case at work, and it is, like, why do we assume you're having a good day's work? You are not having a good day's work if you're constantly being interrupted at work as well. So I'm a big fan of letting people have long stretches of time to get work done, and they'll get plenty of stuff done.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, you know, in improvisation, I've often used the term that it's noisy, loud group mindfulness, because the idea there is that you need to have this intense kind of focus, but with lots of eyes on you and in collaboration with other people. You can't have someone improvise for more than a couple hours without completely burning them out. That level of focus. So I think that's interesting what you're talking about with regard to the 40 hours. Is like, do you really think that 10 more, you're going to get good work?
No. You're exactly right. And that's the funny thing is that people are putting in 60, 70 hours and they think that they're doing better work because of it or more work. I mean, we're all human beings. We get tired. Our mind cannot run that long at a high level. We need to sleep. We need to rest. We need these things. It doesn't matter what industry you're in. The brain doesn't care what industry you're in. You know, bodies have been around for a while. They've figured out that you need to sleep. You need to rest. So I think squeezing in an extra 2 hours or 10 hours or 20 hours a week doesn't really get you anything other than just being, probably spending more time on busy work, to be honest.
Right. And you also say that the real problem are managers and meetings.
Yeah.
I think I know what you mean completely. And I've been a manager, as you have.
I am.
Yeah.
And so I'm the problem sometimes. I ask people, hey, what are you doing? What are you working on? Can I help you? Have any questions? I should just shut up. Like, if they have questions, they should know to ask me. If they want my eyes on something, hopefully they'll ask me. And every time I ask someone, I'm getting in their way and becoming a little bit of a pain. So you have to do it, you know, balance and everything. There's managers aren't all bad by any means, and meetings aren't all bad. It's just excessive management and excessive meetings are definitely bad. And most companies are full of excessive meetings and managers.
You also said meetings have a tendency to procreate, which I find to be so true. And I have been so guilty of this in my time as a manager and leader at Second City is like, oh, great, we have this one meeting that, you know, then we should need to have a smaller meeting and then another meeting in terms of that. And then suddenly your day is booked up and you have no place to do the thing you're supposed to do.
Yeah, they just continue. They continue and continue. Most meetings sort of set the table for the next one. And you know, you've got to put a stop to that. I think if you want to break that pattern, you've really got to put a stop to that. You got to say, like, whatever we're going to discuss today, we're making a decision about. So if you are going to have meetings, like, we're making calls today. Mm. We're not just discussing. We're making calls today. We're making decisions. We're going to move on. Otherwise, if you just discuss, then you're going to discuss again. And then, you know, it just breaks people's days up again. You might spend 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 hours a week in meetings. Some businesses, some industries, that makes sense, but I think in a lot of them it doesn't.
And I mean, essentially, too, you're talking about work, but we're talking about life. And in your book, Rework, one of the lines that popped out to me completely was an extension of this workplace conversation. But you wrote, the real world, that when we talk about the real world, isn't a place, it's an excuse. It's a justification for not trying.
Yeah.
Love that.
Thank you.
Because that is that cliche. It's a dangerous cliche.
Oh, I hear it
to
all
even
the time.
Yeah, right? And say the real world.
And that wouldn't work in the real world. You hear this all the time.
What world is that? Well,
yeah, it's like my world's different than yours. What do you mean the real world? What are you talking about? And it is an excuse. It's basically an excuse not to try something, an excuse to put something down. It's an excuse to say we've tried that and it doesn't work. But so what? I don't care if you've tried it and it doesn't work. It's all about execution. You might execute it differently. I might execute it differently. So we tend to be very careful about whenever we hear the word real world or the phrase that we try to ignore that and go, it doesn't really matter.
I think cliches are to business language what puns are to comedy.
Well, puns are more fun, though.
Yeah, but they're the lowest form of comedy. I mean, it's like the easiest kind of comedy where it's like it's not even really comedy. It's like, you know, when you listen to Garrison Keillor and someone goes, oh, he's a humorist. And I go, do you mean not funny? Because I think that's what humorist means.
Yeah. Right,
and the idea
right,
of the business
right.
cliche.
It'd be a comedian if he was funny.
Yeah. Right, and so many of these cliches get put on. I mean, I almost used ROI early in our conversation and was like, oh, no, stop. They shouldn't be put together anymore.
Yeah.
Everyone talks about the ROI, the ROI.
Yeah.
Like it loses meaning at a certain point. You don't even know what they're talking about.
We don't even think about it. Like I've never ever thought about ROI. It's just not a thing to me. Just like at the end of the day, I want our business to make more money than we spend. That's it. And it's not about ROI this or ROI that or if this piece of it is doing it. Just in general, let's make more money than we spend and we'll be profitable and we can keep staying in business. It's that simple, in my opinion.
So where did you get this incredibly healthy and rare viewpoint about work? Is this something you've always held on to? Are there ideas that have been nuanced through your experience of running your own company?
Some of the managerial stuff comes from when I was working growing up, like part-time jobs. I had great managers and bad managers and great owners.
Oh, tell us about some. Is it the North Shore?
I'll tell you a story. So I used to work at this shoe store called Shelby's, which was a Shelby's Pro Shop.
Totally know Shelby's.
Do you remember Shelby's?
Yeah.
So I used to work at Shelby's.
Got it.
And the owner was this, I'll call her pretty terrible woman, racist. Terrible.
Wow. Yeah. Dead now, I hope.
Probably.
Okay.
Probably. Michael Jordan would come in and buy shoes there, which was amazing for me because I was a huge Bulls fan.
Yeah.
And she would say, watch that guy.
Oh, God.
And I was like, are you kidding me?
You can swear on
anyway, yeah. Flat out. Like, just stuff like that was so... And that's one example. But the other example was she thought everyone was stealing from her. And therefore, like, everyone did end up stealing from her.
Right. Because, self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes. And she didn't trust anybody. And she was watching over everyone's shoulder. And she just had a mean spirit about her that stayed with me. I'm like, that, I would not ever want to treat anyone who works for me that way. How could you be that way? How could you? And when I saw what happened, like, it turned into what she thought it would be, which is right. People were stealing and people didn't trust her and didn't respect her. I never would want to create a place like that. I didn't know at the time. I was like 16 or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's formative. And then I had a great manager who did work there, a guy named Greg Sheehan, who is still alive, who's great. A wonderful manager. Mm-hmm. The owner was bad. He was wonderful. He gave us a lot of space, a lot of trust and autonomy, which was wonderful at 15.
Right.
And he was just great. So, like, I learned a lot from him. I learned what not to be like from her. And then I had a bunch of other jobs, which were kind of a mix. So a lot of that came from those early experiences, but I have just sort of a general, like, bullshit radar about, like, why am I doing that? Like, why am I doing this? Why are we doing this? Why are we going through these paces? Does this make any sense? It's very easy to fall into the trap of just doing what you think you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And if you're just really good at asking yourself why and being a bit more self-aware about what you're doing, a lot of the things you end up doing, if you start to ask yourself about them, you'll realize they're not necessary. And right. I don't know where I got that. But I've always been that way, and it's probably been annoying for a lot of other people at times, but I just know I'm not good at just doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm good at doing what I believe is the right thing to do, which is typically not what you're supposed to do.
Right. Did you ever work for any of the bigger companies? Because I worked for Juul.
Okay.
At the Plaza del Lago in Wilmette.
Yeah.
And that was my first gig.
Yeah.
And I remember very quickly walking in and going, oh, no one has any idea what they're doing.
Right.
And this is just mass hysteria in a box. Mm-hmm. And it works. Mm-hmm. But it is not, it dawned on me very early that this was not some sort of magic that was going on. And in fact, it was teetering at different times, which is absolutely true.
Yeah.
And then I worked for Video Advantage across from the Wilmette Movie Theater, the old video store there. Yeah, it was right downtown Wilmette, which is like three streets.
Yeah.
But I had these great bosses. Uh-huh. And Sandy Goldman, who's still alive, mm-hmm. awesome guy, would have customers come in and they would be complaining about, like, they didn't like this movie. They wanted their money back. And he would just give them their money back. And I'm like, Sandy, what are you doing? He's like, what do I win?
What am I going to win?
What am I going to win with the fight? This is the thing, like, that they will come back or they will not come back. That's the fight. You got to pick your fight kind of thing. And the other thing I love that he always taught me, which is he gets so mad when people in these small businesses, storefront windows, would cover their windows with posters. He's like, you can't see in.
Right.
You got to be able to see in.
He wants to walk into, yeah. Yeah, you want to know what you're walking into.
Yeah.
Little things like that. I am such a fan of small businesses like that. I mm-hmm. love, to me, those are the people I look up to. I look up to people who've been in business for 25 years, 30 years. That's an amazing, amazing run. I mean, you can't be a fluke if you've been in business that long.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I think that I agree that I think most businesses are held together with duct tape.
Yeah.
And we're all figuring out as we go. I really believe that. Just seeing that also helps you realize, to get back to your actual question, which is, had I worked for any big companies?
Yeah.
I'd done work for them as a consultant, like mm-hmm. my own, when I was freelancing, but I've never mm-hmm. worked at a big company. Actually, I worked at Sport Mart when I was growing up a little
bit,
which
one.
Is big, mm-hmm. but not like in my professional life.
Yeah.
But you realize pretty quickly that everyone is just a human and there are very few superhumans and mm-hmm. we're all figuring out as we go. And that always gave me confidence. Like, I could do that.
Right.
I could figure that out. They're
right.
figuring it out. I don't know if they're smarter than me or not, but it doesn't seem like they are. I don't think I'm smarter than them either. We're just all people, and I can figure this stuff out too, and that's how I've always looked at things.
And I think this is an important orientation, and I've seen it among my coworkers as well, which is when they figure out that no one knows what they're doing, that everything's screwed up, they are, oh my God, they're so defeated. And it's funny because I think the orientation of an improviser is like, oh, great. This is going to be fertile ground for play. This is going to be fertile ground for understanding, for making things happen. And I really do think that philosophy of seeing all obstacles as gifts, it sounds good on a bumper sticker, but the truth of it is that nothing starts from perfect. Mm-hmm. Zero. It's not perfect. These are human beings and we're flawed.
Absolutely.
So let's start with that premise. And when we start with that premise, we're not going to wallow in disappointment. And hopefully the thing that we're going to have is the ability to pivot when things do go awry. and the ability to, and it's, it seems like from everything that I've seen you talk about, and indeed in building your company, because you had a different name, you had all these products, right, and you simplified and you adapted and you changed in ways that I don't see that kind of nimbleness existing at a lot of big companies.
Well, big companies are hard. Mm-hmm. They're hard. And I have no interest in big companies personally anyway. I just don't like them for the most part. But that's a pretty big generalization. I have a few that I like. But mm-hmm. I think that the more massive the object, this is just physics, right? The more massive the object, the more energy it takes to change its direction. Mm-hmm. That's just physics. And the same thing is true of big companies. You're a big, huge company. There's lots of mass. You've got huge office buildings. Or you've got lots of people and lots of rules and lots of policies. It's hard to change in those environments. Extremely hard to change. Mm-hmm. It's hard. We have 50 people at our company. It's hard to change, much harder than it was when we were 20 people. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
So that's why I've always felt like keeping things as small as possible is a huge advantage, mm-hmm. which is funny because in business, everyone wants to get big.
Right.
I want to stay small. I want to get big in terms of our impact and, you know, revenues and profits and all that stuff. But I want to keep the company in terms of the number of people who work at the company small, so we can move quickly, so we can make some changes, so we know everyone's first name. That kind of mm-hmm. stuff to me is really valuable. And it's funny because if you talk to big business owners, they'll always say like, I remember when we were that small, it was great. Like, I wish I could do that again. No one ever wishes they were like running a big, huge company again, a public company again. Everyone wants to get back to small because that's actually a lot easier to maneuver.
Yeah. Yeah. The human to human thing's huge. And yeah, the majority of people I know are not necessarily happy who run a lot of companies, mm-hmm. And in part because that sort of worry factor exists. But when they can manage the thing that's in front of them, and they can name the name, that becomes a different thing. Right. You have this great piece where you talk about the immense value in storytelling and editing, and how if you're able to write 3 pages and turn that into 1 page and then 3 paragraphs and 1 paragraph and then finally on a perfectly distilled sentence, you will be completely winning at communication, which I find immensely true. And I'm wondering, like, do you have the one sentence description of Basecamp?
Shit, I'm working on that. It's embarrassing.
It's hard. It's hard. I was trying to do it myself.
Yeah. I mean, the one sentence description that I don't like is... It's a web-based project management tool, which means nothing, but mm-hmm. that's what we've used in the past. We're actually trying to continue to figure out how to describe the product. I'm trying to figure out how to do it in... I'm a big believer in contrasts. So mm-hmm. for me, the way when I talk to people... Here's the actual... Let me step back for a second. No one ever asks you for a one-sentence description of your product. Oh. Like, what does your product do? And then I can actually tell a little bit of a story. Like, well, for example... I'll say, do you use work or do you use email at work? Are you in meetings all day? They'll be like, yeah. I'm like, well, Basecamp's an alternative to that. Mm-hmm. Like, well, what do you mean? Well, then I can get into it. So like, if I can put it in their, in a perspective they understand,
right. the story,
then I can tell the story. But the one liner, like, I've always had a hard time with it because I feel like it doesn't really matter. It's not a real thing. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, we all want to come up with, but you would never use it on somebody.
But you're still looking for it.
I'm still looking for it because it's... Sure. It's can we get there? I'm just curious about can we get there?
Yeah.
I have like 3 sentences. I basically have 2 sentences, but it's still not where I want to be. So I'm still working on it.
It's funny. I was talking to Raj Sisodia, who is the co-founder of Conscious Capitalism, with John Mackey from Whole Foods. So the idea, yeah, can ring
a
bell.
I know Mackey. I don't know him, but I know of him.
Know of his work, yeah. So the idea here being that, you know, good and purpose doesn't need to be separate from profit. And Raj talks about in his book, companies who describe themselves in their sentence in more lofty terms. So there's an aspirin maker that talks about wanting to relieve human suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this, mm-hmm. this idea of how you, I remember I tried to do this for Second City, and I'm like, we bring people joy and teach them how to bring joy in themselves and others.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm trying to get at that root. And it strikes me that you guys are all about, you don't have to give up collaboration because of dysfunction. You know, that, mm-hmm. that there's something in the sense of you're using technology to get past the people bullshit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. We try to do that. We try to do a lot of our communication asynchronously through Basecamp, because I find that a lot of real-time communication is full of people problems, mm-hmm. basically. People feel rushed. They can't think things through, especially in the context of a group trying to communicate in real time. Some people are intimidated by other people. Some people like take the floor and don't give it up. There's a lot of these things that go away when you can write, and you can write something down and someone can read it and they can get back to you when they're ready to get back to you versus right now when you're expecting them to get back to you. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of really interesting things that happen when you write things down versus when you talk about them in person. Mm-hmm. There's a time and a place certainly for talking about things in person, of course, but yeah. there's a lot of time for writing too, and for deliberate consideration and sleeping on it before you get back to someone. I'm a big fan of slowing things down a little bit. I think very, very, very few things need to be discussed right now in real time.
You know, it's interesting contrasting, because I agree 100%. And I think that often, you know, it's easy for us to sort of be like, oh, okay, so we should all be talking, you know, through computers. And that's not what you're saying. Yeah. And in fact, just last week we interviewed a vicar, Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, who is at St. Martin in the Fields in London. And he wrote a book on Christianity and improvisation, you know, ethics. Uh-huh. And one of his ideas that he discussed with us is that for eons, human mankind, if they had a central problem, it was, life and death. It was staving off death, essentially. And we've gotten pretty good at that, and we've been able to figure out ways to live longer. And he said he thinks the problem has changed, and the new problem that is endemic to all of humankind is isolation. Hmm. Which, as I started thinking through, I'm like, wow, in an increasingly technical world,
yeah.
I can see what he means. But it's not just – that's not a tech issue at
right.
all.
Well, we think the world's more connected, but that's a technical – it's like a technical definition.
Right.
Are we actually truly like having better relationships because of that? I'm not sure that that's true at all.
Yes, have
Seems
we
like weaker bonds actually in many cases.
Indeed, and yeah. and perspective taking. So yeah. are we better at taking the perspective of someone else,
no,
especially behind that computer? No.
No, no.
That's the silent, like we just are yelling at people,
yes.
which we'd never do when we meet them in person.
Never. And that's so funny because yeah, I've tried to stay. I have a policy, basically a personal policy, that on Twitter, mm-hmm. I never say anything negative ever. Mm. You can go back through my, like maybe for the last 5 years, because maybe there was some snarky comment way back when. But I'm very conscious about that because it's so easy to just knee jerk about anything.
Yeah.
And not really think it through and then think you've got it all figured out. Oh, I got it all figured out in 110 characters. I can be a snarky, you know, whatever, and tell you the way it really is. Things are complicated and people are complicated and issues are complicated and there's multiple sides to everything. And I've tried to think that through because it's so easy to get into a shouting match where no one's hearing each other. We're
right.
speaking loudly online, technically. We all think we're really clever now,
mm-hmm.
but no one's listening to anybody. So I think if you really want to hammer out an issue between two people that are widely at significant disagreement, I do think it's better to do that in person.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disagreements are better handled in person, actually. Discussions are okay to have virtually, but disagreements are better in person.
Totally.
Yeah.
So if I went to your office today, how many people are at the office?
I wasn't there, so I don't know. Four or five?
I wasn't there.
Yeah. How are you home today?
So four or five, maybe?
Four or five, yeah.
Interesting. And at any given time, it could be more?
It's usually, it seems to work out to about five. Now, we have 50 people in the company,
right.
14 in Chicago.
Okay.
But 35 or 36, however you count. Like they're spread across 30 cities around the world. So we have a very remote workforce. But even in Chicago, most people work at home a couple days a week. So it depends. Any day you go in, there might be a mix of four or five or six different people. And that includes me. I work from home, or at least hybrid. I'm kind of at home in the morning, sometime in the office in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But what you would hear is nothing or very quiet.
Hmm.
We have a very interesting culture around that, which we call library rules, basically.
Okay.
We treat our office like a library.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk into a library and everyone knows how to behave. You keep your voice down. People are studying. They're thinking. They're learning. And that's the same way our office is. So it's very quiet. And then we have rooms where you can go, which are almost soundproof, where you can go and like have a loud discussion with people around a table and hammer some issues out. But you're not interrupting people who are working because we want to keep the volume down so the distractions are at a minimum.
anyone I work with is just laughing at this because
right.
they're like,
"You're so loud, right?"
Well, and me personally, I'm the worst. I am constantly interrupting people to do bits, to find out weird information, to give them information that they don't need to have about me.
But you know, you're in a different business too.
We're in a different kind of knowledge exchange, people exchange, tone.
You're in a collision business. I think
we are in a collision business.
You want to collide. You want ideas to collide and bits like. We're more of a single track in terms of people are heads down working on something that's really challenging for them at the moment, and they need to hold the whole thing in their head. And you, if someone interrupts you, like, you can lose that whole thought. Same thing could be true, I guess, in your business, but I think it's a little bit different.
It is. No, it can be true when you're doing solitary writing, but most of the writing that we do is with others in that noise. And it requires – the thing is – when we're doing our work, we are rapid prototyping.
Right.
You need to do your work and then get to rapid prototyping. We just do it all at the same time.
Right. Yeah,
so
that's a good way to think about it.
Is that how you think about it?
You guys are rapid prototyping?
We started using that term recently. We called it rapid people prototyping because the idea, and it's really, it emanated from this idea around focus groups because a lot of people in our corporate area, you know, like to do focus groups to test out stuff. And we're like, God, you know, at Second City, we've been creating original content for 60 years with immediate focus. And the idea there is that the talent on stage, when they don't get a laugh or get a groan, or whatever, they make their little adjustments then. And I don't need an audience member 30 minutes later to come back and tell our experts what they were doing right or wrong. They know that, but they also don't know it in the moment, and that's when they need to use it. So this idea of like immediate feedback adjustment is how we create. And I think it leads itself to what I call more honest and truthful comedy. Gets away from that pun factor. It allows for a sort of complexity. And then when I looked at manufacturing, it was sort of like, okay, well, you have these beautiful objects that you can't just send out into the universe, but you have to. So you're sending out imperfect like we are, but it's a different lag.
I've always found I use this comedy metaphor, I don't know, a lot to talk about why people ask me, like, you do a lot of public speaking, why do you do that? I say it's like a comedian, basically, where I have to go and practice at clubs and see what works. I don't know what's going to hit. I don't know what lines work. I don't know what people resonate with. And you kind of keep doing that, and then eventually you put the results in a book.
Right.
A book for us is like our HBO special, right?
Yeah,
it's like
you
go travel the country, you work in clubs, you see what works, what doesn't, you hone, you adjust, and then you do your HBO special. That's what our book is, basically.
Yep.
And so I love that. I also think, this is an aside, but I think stand-up, I'm a big fan of stand-up comedy. I don't really watch a lot of improv. I've never, I don't know why. It's like, I don't really know.
Because half of it's no good, but that's all right.
That could be it. I don't know.
Because they're improvising.
Could be. I mean, it's cool, though, because it's very real.
Yes.
Like, the process.
Yeah, the great improv is the best.
But I think comedy is just one of the hardest jobs there is, because unlike music, if you play something and you're up there with a guitar and you suck, like, people still clap for you because they're polite.
Yeah, right.
People
but if
laugh,
they're not laughing,
laugh.
Oh, it's the worst.
It's got to be the worst.
Yep.
It's got to be horrifying.
Yep. All right, who do you like?
Comedy-wise?
Mm-hmm.
I like Louis C.K.
Great.
I like Pryor and those guys. I like Dave Attell. I like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy. I can't remember his name now.
You strike me as a John Mulaney fan. Do you know his work?
I recognize the name, but I can't place the comedy.
So Mulaney also grew up in the North Shore.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he has a lot of, like, really funny sort of stuff from there.
He had
a TV show that was not terrific, but,
okay,
you know, very sort of insightful and smart. And
yeah.
I think the thing about, you know, stand-up comedy, which is so much different from our work, because the work of improvisers and ensembles is all about sort of building each other up.
Mm-hmm.
And a stand-up only has that audience, and that audience has kicked their ass 90% of the time.
Right.
You know, no one gets into comedy because they're well adjusted. That's true.
Yep.
And in stand-up comedy, in particular, it is a special kind of miserable that all of them will tell you. They you know, Patton Oswalt being, you know, one of these people who's so great on Twitter and so, you know, like is awash in misery as a factor, which also makes him so entertaining because these comedians are our truth tellers. I'm bringing this all full circle to our earlier part of the conversation, which is, it's messy and bad.
Yep.
Like, and they're able to tell it, and we're like, yep, you're right, it is. And then why do we try to pretend it's not when we go to work?
Right.
What is?
They are truth tellers. You're absolutely right. They're the only ones telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I read this really interesting piece. This is going to be a weird analogy, but I read this really interesting piece about Trump. I forget who wrote it now. About how he's actually more like, a lot of the stuff he does is almost like comedy.
Insult comedy.
Yeah. It's like if he was actually a comedian mm-hmm. on stage mm-hmm. and the setting was comedy, people would be laughing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting how that is. Like he had that piece about that line or that thing about like McCain. He's like, I like, you know, my war heroes wouldn't get captured or something, which is like you could almost imagine someone with more deft kind of molding that into a joke,
a Bill Maher joke.
Yeah, Bill Maher joke, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But people are like kind of horrified about that, just the thought that a politician would talk that way. But it's kind of an interesting thing. Anyway,
no, he plays the crowd. I mean,
he's
very good at the crowd. And he knows what this. This is also, I think, one of his downfalls in a political way of getting elected is that he can't help himself. If he feels the crowd going a certain way, he's going to keep going and keep going. And he crosses the line. He brings it back. Just like a comedian.
Yes.
And it's fascinating to watch.
It is. I find it totally fascinating
to watch. And she is a terrible comedian and a terrible improviser.
Yes.
She just does not have that quality of connection to an audience. And, you know, again, you start to then go, you know, well, what are we electing comedian in chief? Are we, you know, what do we want? And, and again, there's other issues on both sides with that. But absolutely, in terms of, you know, one seems to really thrive in the rhythm of a campaign.
Right.
And the other seems like constantly behind it.
Yeah. One's giving sort of, I think, like Hillary gives more of a speech mm-hmm. and Trump would give more of like a
performance.
Yeah, performance. It's more of a performance. It's super interesting to watch this, I mean, crazy year.
Well, and I think, again, when we're talking about leadership inside, you know, a business, we've seen that in business, mm-hmm. that these leaders who are performers.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that might work, but then you're sort of like, you're really a spokesperson.
Right. You've got to have the structure behind you to be able to deliver also. I mean, you know, some of the best business people are showmen in a sense, and mm-hmm. that because they're business is about sales. And a lot of everything's really about sales. You're selling the line, you're selling the joke, you're selling the concept, you're selling the product. It's all the same. But of course, a comedian who's on stage can tell a joke. They don't have to back it up with anything. Like if you're on stage and you're a business person, you're like pitching a product or whatever. Like you've got to deliver that product. You've got to deliver that point of view. So while they might be a showman, you know, they have to have the people behind them.
They get caught.
Pull it off.
Yep. Yeah. They get caught. Yeah. All right. Before, and we're coming to the end. I hate this. And I'm going to ask you about a yes and story. But before that, we talked about cliches.
Yeah.
And this is one I had not considered. And you were taking people to task for using the term everyone or no one.
Right.
And I was like, well, what's wrong with that? And you're like, and I'm like, oh no, you're right. There is no everyone or no one.
I use it too, and I should stop, which mm-hmm. is, you know, you're trying to make a point. You're like, everyone thinks this, or nobody would do that, and that's not true.
It is probably scientifically...
Probably scientifically not true.
Untrue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the problem is it's used as a basis to form a lot of arguments and to make a lot of arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this huge assumption that comes with it when you say... And there's a lot of gravity that comes with the phrase, like, everyone believes this, or no one does this. And we see it in software all the time. We're looking at a piece of software that we're making, and we're like... Well, nobody's going to click that, or like everyone would figure that out, and it's just not true. And you just got to be careful about that, and understand that, you know, that's just not a true statement.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of back off a bit and make your point in a different way.
It's interesting. You clearly have an interest in language, and what I flash on with that was when Colbert first launched the Colbert Report, and my wife and I are in bed watching this. And my wife was his roommate in college, and Stephen they were at Northwestern together, and Stephen was my first company in 1992 at the Second City as a producer. So we know Stephen quite well, and he's doing his thing, and people are and like we're astonished. We're like, he can't keep this up. This is crazy. And then as we're talking about, it, and everyone's like, he is nailing, you know, the right. And I'm like, no, that's not what he's doing. In fact, what Stephen is interested in. He loves language. And what a lot of people don't know is the Colbert character was really based more on Noah Adams from NPR mm-hmm. than Bill O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about someone who he found insufferable, who used language as a weapon ways that he thought were, you know, and he included these other layers, but it was all about the manipulation of the communication.
Yeah.
Which was the genius of that show over a 10-year arc, completely. And it's like, I don't know, like if this was something that you figured out early was a thing for you, and it maybe was when you talk about your early jobs.
I love words. I don't know. I've always loved them, but I've not. I've I've become a pretty good writer, I think, but I was mm-hmm. not a good writer growing up. I hated English and writing. I hated things I was had, again, getting back to like, you have to write a paper on this topic you don't know anything about. Like, I just didn't, it did not interest me.
Mm-hmm.
But when I could use words to express things that I wanted to share and share them with a lot of people at once, I really got into it. So I love language. I don't read a whole lot I read mostly nonfiction.
Yeah.
I find the world interesting enough, to be honest.
There's a lot of stories out there.
Yeah. But I love words, and I love people who use words in interesting ways. But, you know, yeah. So you could tell that he loves language. You can tell when you watch Colbert.
Yeah.
He loves it.
And there's a music to it. There's
wonderful.
Yeah, dances, and there's a music to it. Yeah, I love that. Okay, so we ask every guest this.
Oh, I just hit the cough button.
Did you hit it when you did it? That's so you didn't hear anything. That's right. Him hitting the cough button. First time this happened in the studio. Podcast is called Getting to Yes And. And Yes And is the, you know, maybe the number one or the earliest tenet of improvisation, which is you can't say no. To build something out of nothing with other people, can't say no. And you can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute. And this is not just a idea for improvisation. It's the world. Because none of us are handed a script when we get up in the morning. Hopefully, this is not the Truman Show. Do you have a moment that you can recall, and it can be a life moment, a work moment, a relationship moment, when you probably were going to say no, but you pivoted and you said yes and?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
There was when I got out of college, someone offered me a job as a creative director at a small web design firm. Basically, mm-hmm. creative director wasn't even a thing because it was him. And he was going to hire his second employee. But anyway, he gave me a big title. And it was in San Diego, and I went to school in Arizona. I was planning on going home to Chicago after this. But I said, yeah, you know what? Why not? I'll take the job. And so I moved out to San Diego, and that was important for me because it made me I quit after 3 months,
mm-hmm.
and I realized that I'm unemployable. That's what I realized.
Yeah.
And I would not have known that
uh-huh.
had I not taken that job immediately out of college.
Mm-hmm.
In a separate place, in a separate location where I didn't know anybody, I didn't have anything to fall back on. I realized very quickly that I was not, like if I knew a lot of people there, I probably would have muddled through it because like, oh, I like the place, I know people. But I realized, because since I didn't have any of that, all I had was the job, and I did not like the job. And I realized that one of the reasons I didn't like the job is because I had different ideas about how to do things than mm-hmm. he did. And I just realized pretty quickly that I was unemployable. And so, because of that, I've never looked for another job ever. I've always figured I'm just going to make it on my own and figure out how to do it on my own. And I always have. But it was saying yes to that that made me realize that I didn't want a job.
Yeah.
Yes to a job made me realize I didn't want one.
Basically. Right. Well, you can yes and to quitting. I mean, this it's not.
That's what I did.
Yeah, that's exactly what you did, and that is not a bad use of yes and.
Yeah,
this is, you know, as affirming as this stuff is, it doesn't always mean that the end result means you got to do something shitty. It hopefully means the opposite, that you are tapping into what is creative and true for you.
Yeah, it was a major change for me because I'd always sort of knew when I was younger, I sold like slightly illegal things to my friends, like things like
slightly.
Well, things like knives and like, you know,
uh-huh.
boy stuff. You
yeah,
know?
So
and,
not heroin.
No, it wasn't like drugs, but it was stuff you're supposed to be 18 at least
yes,
to have. Right now,
sure.
It's like 15 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this bug to be an entrepreneur in a sense, but you know. Anyway, it really made sense to me when I quit this other job, but I was only able to quit because I accepted it, and that was the yes and then I'm out kind of thing.
I love it. Jason, thank you for coming on the podcast. If you want to get more information about Jason, you can go to www.basecamp.com, and his stuff's online. It's at Amazon. The TED Talk's awesome. Check it out. We'll see you next week on Getting to Yes And. Well, I've been working in a cold-